Welcome to a worldwide online meeting with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California, on December 9th, 2012.
Hello, everybody. This is John. I'm really happy to be here with you. This is, as Carla said, the last Sunday online meeting of the year. So rather than try to say something new, I'd like to take this opportunity to summarize the current state of our understanding of our work. We are learning all the time, so that our current understanding of our work is always developing and changing and moving. It's kind of a moving target. Although the heart of it is exceedingly simple, the understanding of it gets kind of complicated. So simply stated, we believe that we have found the actual solution to the almost universal experience of our human lives to be wrong somehow, unsatisfying, untrustworthy, almost more trouble than it's worth. And before a solution could be found, we had to find the root cause of the problem. You can't solve something if you don't know what the problem is in the first place. And for this reason, I think that it's important that you consider and reflect upon what it is that we have come to see as the root problem of the fundamental alienation from life as a human being. We believe the root cause of this is what we have come to call the fear of life. And even that's not entirely obvious what we're talking about when we say the fear of life, because the fear of life is not so much a direct experience of fearfulness and anxiety, although it certainly is the cause of great fearfulness and great anxiety as the experience of life itself. Fearfulness and anxiety are part of its symptoms. The fear of life itself is if experienceable at all, very faint. The fear of life in its effect and its power over our experience of human life is a context. It's not an experience. It's a context. A context that begins to form at birth and develops over time into an all-inclusive kind of guiding assumption on which all our desires and aversions, all our ideas about what is needed and what is despised and to be rejected, and all of our neurotic habits of relationship that spoil our experience of life are built. The fear of life is the context that shapes those things. And the context assumes that life is inherently untrustworthy and fearful, and the effects of this context, therefore, are the cause of all human psychological misery. This is what we see to be the actual cause of the problem of being a human being in this world, is that the entire psychology, the entire mechanism by which we experience life as a human being is poisoned by an underlying, unseen, and unsolved context that based on the idea that life is not to be trusted. This is what we see to be the cause of all human misery. Not all human problems, and not all human pain, and not all human confusion, but the cause of all human psychological misery. It's important to see this in order to have any... It's not important to see this to fix it, but it's important to see this to have some understanding of how it is that the simple act that we talk about has the effect it has, the over overwhelming effect it has on actually doing away with our distrust and dissatisfaction with life as a human being. Now, for thousands of years, we've been fighting to fix ourselves or our lives, and nothing we have done over all those thousands of years has had much success beyond the very few who have stumbled, we believe, upon the cure we speak of when they thought they were doing something else. The few who have escaped from the fog of fearfulness and anxiety have escaped from them by accident while they thought they were doing something else. And there's not many of them. And because they thought they were doing something else at the time, they have not found a way, we have not found a way in all those thousands of years to communicate the solution in a way that could be useful to the teeming billions of us who suffer from the fear and its symptoms. Turns out that the cure is more simple than anyone could have imagined, more simple than anyone could have come to by trying to understand, anything, really. The cure for the fear of life, and this is the second part of the only things that we are interested in, the cure for the fear of life is to try to look at yourself directly with your mind's eye, following no ideas you may have about what or who you are. The cure for the fear of life is to try to look at yourself directly, freshly. Honoring no ideas, no past ideas. This act of looking can seem hard, but is really so easy, and the actual experience of you is so small that you may not know that you've actually seen yourself for some time. Turns out that that really doesn't matter. It's the looking that counts. The seeing is optional. So that's it. That's all we have to offer. That's all we really have to talk about, although it can get pretty complicated. That's all we really have to talk about. The problem with human life is an unconscious conviction that life is to be feared, and the cure for that problem is to look at yourself. And just to be clear, the yourself that is to be looked at is nothing more than the faint sensation of what you would call me in the background of absolutely everything. And it's actually easier than can be imagined. Right now, for example. Right now. This can be done any time, in any context, in any circumstance whatsoever. Right now, as you're listening to me speak to you, just take a moment. Take a breath. Notice that your attention is resting on the sound of my voice. Notice that. Notice what that feels like. And now, see if you cannot take that same focus of attention and find you here. Not the thoughts, not the emotions, not the expectations, not the experiences, none of that. See if you can find you here, what you would call me. Because that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for anything special. We're not looking for anything magnificent. We're not looking for anything at all except the simple, uncomplicated feel of you here. Now, if you tried that, If you actually were able to try that, I can pretty much guarantee you that the end is certain. That the end of fearfulness, the end of neurotic anxiety, the end of aggressive and hostile alienation from life itself, that's on the way out. Truly. That's all it takes. Just that. Just trying. The loss of the fearfulness, the loss of the sense of distance between you and your life, the sense of a buffer zone that you can hold life at bay while you examine what's happening and decide whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, that collapses. That's gone. That will disappear very quickly. There may be some confusion attached to it as it goes, but it's done, just with the act itself. And having found this to be the case in so many people, including ourselves, first of all, Carla and I, having found this to be the case and seeing its strange power at work for a number of years now, we've been at this for a while, we've come to believe that this suggestion can and must be brought to the attention of all humanity as soon as possible. And we are convinced that given its utter simplicity and harmlessness, coupled with the incredible power of modern communications technology, we are convinced that this actually can be brought to the human world quite quickly. So our central purpose in all that we do here, the overarching purpose of all that we do here, of all the conversations we have, of all the of everything we do, our central purpose, the overarching purpose, is to bring this suggestion to the world of human beings, and in the process develop the means and understandings needed to make the transformation from a world of humans based on fear to a natural human community based on the magnificence of the actual experience of human life, to make that transformation and that transition as easy on us all as possible. And that's the only hard part. Really. That's the only the hard part is the organization and the working at it and the effort to make this spread throughout the world. Everything else is easy. Finding the resources and the skill and the skillful help to do this is hard. Doing it is easy. So that's all I have to say for this last Sunday meeting of the year. I'm willing to talk to you about anything, and I am especially willing and happy to talk to you about what I just summed up for you. I just wanted to give you a summary of where we stand now. And this is where we stand now. We know what the problem is. We know how to cure that problem. And we want to bring this to the world of all humanity. That's where we stand. So now I'm going to shut up, and we'll talk about anything you want to talk about. But I'm going to shut up and turn the floor over to you. And as soon as you have something that you want to talk to me about, I'll talk to you. Okay? Thank you so much for your time and attention here. Hi, Adrian.
John, it's a bit difficult for me to talk about this, although it's a common thing, I guess. So, I think I do have, as other people have reported, I do have this alternating states, like periods of time of comparative, not complete calm and comparatively relaxed, and then what I experience sometimes and even lately. It's like when confronted with this apparent fact that there are people who have went all the way and they feel that this problem has been resolved, such as yourself, I feel kind of, well, I feel very imperfect. I feel very kind of ashamed and not 100% clear to me. I have a tendency to be, I mean, more than a tendency. I'm not a very, I don't know how to say. I'm kind of lazy, and some people were of opinion that I am complacent, that I, you know, that I'm going for the easy solution. That has been kind of constant in the way it was perceived when I was, say, in my childhood, in my adolescence, and so on, and even later on. So on the positive side, I can feel in me, you know, at times, as I say, I can feel this thing, like, yes, I this thing that is my nature, it has some sweet quality about it. So at times I do feel it, and just as I said, at times it looks like it's well, almost a simple recollection and not more, and the bitterness and this stink, this pang of guilt reemerges, just as it always did. So that's pretty much my report to you. Hopefully I was clear and true to, you know, true to what I feel.
Okay. I want to try to say this very clearly. I've spoken about this often, and I don't think I have ever quite got to the heart of the matter. There are a couple things at work here. One is you. You are here. There's no question about that, and you know that. You have seen that to be the case, and you have no confusion about that. Turns out that the fact that you have no confusion about that has very little effect on the actual experience of being alive as a human being. Turns out that the understanding of things actually doesn't give us much of anything, because what we are dealing with is not an error in our understanding or an error in our understanding at all. What's at work here is instead thought much more fruitfully as a disease, kind of an autoimmune disease. Now this disease, and just bear with me here, this disease, which is the context, it's not an experience, it's a context that holds that life is untrustworthy and to be feared. This disease is the foundation of all of the ways that our minds develop with the psychological structures and so forth that comprise our minds along with the experiences. So that the misery and the experience and the confusion and the fearfulness and the doubt and the questioning and all of that is part of the symptoms of the fear itself. They are psychological mechanisms and neurotic habits of behavior and relationship and so forth that are not subject to being dissolved by understanding or acceptance or denial or any other psychological mechanism that we have brought to bear against them. Since they are symptoms of a disease, they are mechanical. They have no agency to them. And in the absence of the context in which they were formed, they begin to fade away. They begin to fall away. What we've found to be the case is, and this is my own personal experience and Karna's experience, as well as the experience of many people now who have been in contact with us, what we've found to be the case is let me just make a sidetrack here to the fact that the looking itself is of no consequence. There's nothing that's gained from actually from the experience of you. The experience of you is simple and uncomplicated and not very interesting at all. That's why we are involved in these lives in the first place. But these mechanisms come into being over time in the course of our lifetime, and they have the characteristic of being the default point of view from which we experience everything that happens in our lives. So that if something appears in life that is confusing or unsettling or complicated, what generally comes to the forefront in relationship to that difficulty is some neurotic psychological mechanism and so forth. Okay. Now they don't go away automatically. They go away automatically, but they don't go away instantaneously. The truth is that especially among those of us who are getting long in the tooth, the truth is that many of them may persist for the rest of our lives. As time goes on, their presence becomes more kind of comical than it becomes problematic. But here's what happens when the looking occurs. So anyway, what I'm saying is that it is to be expected that there will be a persistence of neurotic habits of relationship with experiences in life until the mechanisms that are the cause of that neurotic experience fall away as a result of having lost their reason for existence in the first place. What we've found is that what seems actually to be happening that is the cause of all of that is that in the act of looking, the distance between me and my life pretty much vanishes instantly. I have a theory, a hypothesis as to how this works, but it's beside the point here. The fact as reported routinely from my experience and Carla's experience and reported routinely by others is that buffer zone, that sense of being able to hold life at arm's length, is lost to us very quickly after the looking. So that what happens now is that after a lifetime of learning new ways and new strategies and new techniques for keeping life at arm's length, those strategies and techniques no longer work. So that from the very beginning, after the looking, we find ourselves really face-to-face, engaged and immersed in the actual experience of life as it is, human life as it is. And we're unprepared for that. We have, over the course of our lifetime, developed and deployed a whole army of mechanisms, the sole purpose of which is to keep us safe from that raw, unfiltered, conditioned experience of life. This can be really troubling. This can cause a lot of confusion and anguish even in the period following the looking. We've seen many reports of this. In fact, I just think I read something from someone just this morning reporting that there was there's a period of kind of calm and freshness and clarity. which then kind of collapses into a worse, a really worse experience than was the case prior to the looking. And that over time, and I know this from myself, over time, as we learn how to have the human relationship with human life that is possible to us, we become more skillful at understanding and dealing with rising phenomena of that nature. And also the neurotic mechanisms themselves fall away. They continue to fall away until they're gone forever, until they're all gone. So what I'm saying is that there's the looking, and then there's a period that we used to call recovery, and I'm kind of moving away from that now because I think it's there's some things about that that imply stuff that isn't really the case. Like it implies that there's this period when you just have to wait for it to be over, after which everything will be okay. And that's not the case. What you're experiencing is the experience of your life mediated and distorted by the mechanism through which you're experiencing it, which are these things that have come into being to protect you from life. Turns out that if you do nothing, you may suffer and flop around for a number of years, as I did, wondering what in the world is going on and why am I this way sometimes and this way other times, and why do I continue to get caught and trapped into these bad ideas and wrong feelings and all of that stuff. If you do nothing, they will all fall away on their own, and the end will be the same as it is for everyone. The end will be you engaged and immersed in your human life, illuminated by the undistorted light of human intelligence, life that is sometimes difficult, sometimes confusing, sometimes easy, sometimes clear, sometimes not so clear, but the unpredictability and the fickleness of the experience of life no longer will trouble you, as if there was something fundamentally wrong here. Instead, you'll find yourself able to actually joyfully and intelligently and with good effect, you'll find yourself able actually to do something about the way your life unfolds in ways that you could not have imagined in the past. Because, you know, the truth is that in this moment, as the life is present here in this moment, there's nothing you can do about the way it looks in this moment. Nothing. It is as it is. But it turns out that there's things you can do that can affect the way the circumstances of life develop over time. I'll get to that in a minute. So if you do nothing, if you just ride it out, and from what you're saying, your experience is not by any means unique or even uncommon. The experience of having periods of relative calm and peacefulness, and punctuated by periods of a storm and confusion and misery. If you do nothing about that, everything will work out in the end. I tell you that because it took me many years for it to work out in the end, but it did. It'll work out in the end. But it turns out that once you see that what's actually occurring here is not something that just needs to be endured, but what's actually occurring here is the ongoing unfolding of your life seen through lenses that themselves are distorting, then you begin to see that the one thing you can do, and in fact it's the thing you did to accomplish the looking in the first place, the one thing you can do is you can always choose where to put your attention. you actually have some control over what you attend to. So, and for the most part, that goes unnoticed. And for most of us, for most of our lives, the significance of that is missed. But you have some control over where you put your attention. And it turns out that when seeing life through the distorted lenses of psychological mechanisms that have come into being, founded on the unexamined assumption that there's something wrong here, that there's a feel to that that doesn't feel good. It feels sickly. Attention is naturally resting on that feeling of sickliness because that's where it goes, naturally. It goes to whatever is the most, the strongest experience present in your life at the time. But it turns out that it doesn't need to go there, that there really is no need for you to attend to the sickly feeling that comes from viewing life through distorted lenses. Turns out you can deliberately and with conscious intent decide to move your attention from that that doesn't need attending to and place it on something that is safe and neutral and reliable. What I recommend is that you place it on the sensation of your breath as it comes in and out of your body through your nose. And we've found in the month or 2 months that we have been working with this idea, we've found that that's amazingly effective. It seems that your attention is the energy that these mechanisms require in order to continue being present and in operation. So that when you decline to give these things attention, the sickly feeling, the wrongness and all of that, when you just decline simply, not as a matter of demonization or denial, but you simply and clearly decline to attend to them and move your attention to something natural and easy like your breath, that those things that you actually solve the problem in the moment because the mechanism itself will just kind of go away. And not only do you solve the problem in the moment, you hasten the departure of those neurotic mechanisms. You hasten it every time you decline consciously to attend to them. Now, that's a lot of words, but what I'm talking about is really quite simple. It's just as simple as noticing that you're attending to something that doesn't need attending to. And you can't do that all the time. I mean, you know, most of the time when we're caught in these whirlpools of misery, we don't even know it's happening. You know, we don't even know we're on the train, much less how to get off it. But every once in a while, you'll notice that you're doing that. You'll notice that what you're looking at, what you're attending to, is that bad feeling. And whenever that happens, you just deliberately decide to decline to attend to it anymore and deliberately move your attention to something physical, like your breath. And this not only relieves the immediate distress, it not only hastens the departure of this particular neurotic mechanism and all the others that are piled up behind it, it also begins, since what we're dealing with here, you know, this experience of sickliness is part of your life. That's, you know, it's the presence of these neurotic mechanisms are part of your life. So that what you're experiencing is your actual life as it's unfolding. And it turns out that by beginning to utilize the power you have over your attention in that way, you also are beginning to learn freshly, free of the fog of fear, how to develop skillful, self-reliant means for the navigation and understanding and development of your experience of life. So what, to sum it up, what you're experiencing is not unusual. The fact that it's taking a long time is not unusual. We have a lot of experience with things of this nature, and we have seen that there is a simple thing that can be done, which is simply to decline to attend to neurotic feeling senses and instead attend to something natural and reliable. And to begin now to accept and honor and become good at the living of your own life as a human being within the constraints that come from being alive as a human being, as any creature. Also, I don't know if you go to the forums, but I advise you very strongly to begin paying attention to what's going on in the forums at our website, the community center at our website, because this view that I have just put forward here, you will see present there among people just like yourself, some of whom are arriving with really kind of acute distress as a result of the unexpected intimacy of the relationship with life, others who have been through a good part of it, and some who have been through the whole thing, and that people come to report their experiences, and people come there to be helpful to those who are reporting problems. And you will see a lot there just by reading the postings there that will give you considerable basis for understanding what's happening to you and for understanding what can be done to be helpful. The fact of your laziness is beside the point. I am certain that I am the laziest creature that God ever put on this planet. I'm certain that I way outdo you in laziness. I have 70 years of laziness. And it turns out that laziness isn't anything, really, and that despite the fact that I am still have this sense of, well, I'd just as soon be doing nothing as doing this, that doesn't affect my actual experience or relationship or navigation and usefulness of life whatsoever. Laziness is no bar. In fact, laziness might actually be a feature in this. It's the less excited we are about things, the easier things tend to go. So, is that helpful at all, Adrian?
Yes. So I was almost laughing now when you I was actually laughing when you told me about your laziness and so on. So yeah, it's what can I say? It is it was encouraging, and it took out well, at least in part, at least for the moment, this thing of feeling, you know, like feeling uneasy that you mentioned before.
Yes. But keep in mind, right, that the fact that it relieved a little bit of the uneasiness is of really no consequence. The most important thing that can happen as a result of this conversation is that you begin to act on your own initiative to try to do what I've suggested in order to discover for yourself whether what I'm saying is true or false. Do you hear that?
Okay, you mentioned the breathing, the observation of breathing, that in some form or another I am doing from time to time when I think about it started doing this some time ago when we had an interest in yoga. So yes, at times even in an automatic way, I may change the flow of my breathing or perhaps put some attention in my breathing. With respect to the forum, no, I have very little, or almost I haven't gone there, and I will go there. I wanted to say something else. In terms of things that make life easier, I tend to feel that we may have, I mean, some of us anyways, may have a tendency to despise simple things. And breathing, observing breathing is a fairly simple thing. Now, you mentioned also putting the attention or turning the attention off the, this psychological discomfort onto something neutral as breath is. Some people even recommend putting something positive, like how do you feel when you have what you want, when your desires are satisfied, and so on.
And that's just an abstraction. We have resorted to abstraction for 5,000 years now. What I'm saying is that abstraction is of no use to us except as a means of considering different things and so forth. What I'm talking about here is an actual act that can be done, and there's nothing special about the breath. It's not like the breath is some special metaphysical phenomenon. It's just that what's important is the moving of attention and the growth in skillfulness and effectiveness in being able to control where you put your attention. That's what I'm suggesting we work on. We don't work on finding ways to ease the pain in the moment. We're easing the pain in the moment for sure, but what we're doing that's much more important is becoming self-reliant and developing our own ability to do what seems to be the only thing we really have much control over. So it's not... do you follow that? Do you see the difference?
I think I understand, yes.
So I tell you to move your attention to your breath, not in order to give you respite from a present unpleasant experience, but in order to show you that attention on that unpleasantness is entirely optional and that it is entirely within your power and your ability to decline to attend to that. And it, as it happens, it's exercising that simple skill. And you can't always do it, attention gets lost sometimes, often. But exercising that skill and sharpening your ability to notice the times when it's possible to do that, to exercise that skill, will serve you throughout the entire life. And it's not going to make life easy. Life isn't all that easy. It's not going to make life like simple. Life isn't all that simple. You're the simple thing here. Life is what you're here to enjoy and engage in. It's not going to make life simple. It's not going to make life easy, but it's going to make life really, really interesting and satisfying and so forth. You follow me?
Yes, I believe that in general I have noticed this in what you are saying in general, that you are not exactly a champion of the immediate relief of there is an expression for it. What is it like? You're not exactly a champion of instant gratification. You are more a champion of doing something that in the long run is serving its purpose.
Yes, right. And the thing about it is, Adrian, that from my point of view, once you've looked, the outcome is certain. The only thing that is uncertain is how difficult and how useful and how useful the experience is of the ongoing regeneration of the psychology.
Yes, I have had the impression, whether it's entirely my imagination or not, of course, I don't really know. And it's like, you speak sometimes about lack of clarity and so on. And I would add lack of certainty, doubt. Doubt is not, of course, a bad thing. So just before I go back to this, just wanted to say that in my report I concentrated on the negative, but there is also the positive that somehow seemed associated to to self-inquiry and whatever spiritual interest I may have and so on. But moving back to the instant thing and to reaction to it, I had sometimes the impression that even trying to go directly to what you are as opposed to what goes on in your mind, your feelings and your thoughts, also has sometimes, in my mind, at least, in my imagination at least, it has a quality of soothing, of sweetness to it. Sometimes, not always, but it looks like this. Again, that may be just my impression.
Oh, there's no question that for many, the act of trying to look at oneself produces some faint calmness and peacefulness and pleasantness, and that actually shouldn't be very surprising, but I don't want to get too much into this, but this is kind of hooked up with the whole way in which we have looked at what needs to happen in order for me to be finished with the misery of being a human being. And pretty much consistently over the millennia, what we have settled on is the idea that what I need to do is have less experience, basically. To have less experience, the experience that I really want is the experience of kind of empty clarity and peacefulness and no trouble, no discontent, none of the things that characterize the experience of human life. So that, and this is entirely consistent with what I see to be the root cause of it, which is the fear of life, because the fear of life is what pushes us toward wanting to go back to sleep. And so much of what we have done over the millennia, even in the name of waking up, if you look at the actual goal of it, it turns out to be pretty much indistinguishable from going back to sleep. Less experience, total calmness, nothing happening, no thought, no mind, no me, just this empty peacefulness. And that seems obvious to me from my standpoint. It seems obvious to me that although we have called these efforts, because we know what we want to do is wake up, but crippled as we are by the psychology, we try to wake up by going back to sleep. So the availability of methods and means whereby we can have the experience of empty peace and calm and nothing happening, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's a perfectly legitimate thing, perfectly legitimate part of the really kind of infinite picture of the possibility of experience of human life. But it cannot be our goal. The only way we can reach that goal is by going totally back to sleep. The only way we can reach that goal is to lose self-consciousness, to lose our minds, to lose our thoughts, to lose the confusion, to lose the clarity, to lose the entire suite of wildness that is human existence. So it doesn't mean much to me. There's a lot of things we can do that produce relief, feelings of relief and softness and all that. Now I resort to them myself, along with other things, as just part of my life, part of the things that I can do with my life. But if we approach our lives and if we approach the problem that being human seems to present to us from the standpoint that the best thing I can possibly accomplish is to be rid of this life, to be rid of the experience of this life, I guarantee you we will not be happy in life. Whatever has brought us here, the infinite vast ocean of cause and effect that has created our presence here, by whatever name you call it or whatever understanding you have of it, whatever it is that has brought us here, has brought us here precisely because of the fact that in this solar system anyway, human consciousness is the most exquisitely aware and capable of experiencing the boundless capacity for producing experience that is the reality of existence. I'm not sure I got that through, but do you follow that?
Yes, I think you're saying that among the life forms that are present on Earth, we are the most developed, the most capable of experience a wide variety of things.
Yes, right. Experiencing it, you know, and having the sense of being a person experiencing it. It is the sense of personness that I believe is entirely unique to the human creature in the solar system. The sense of personness. And of course, we have in the past, and I certainly among us, we have in the past come to the conclusion that that very sense of personness is the problem. And that's to be expected since it is the sense of personness that allows us to have this incredible range of experience and intelligent relationship with. See?
Yes, that's right.
So it's useful to be aware of the pull of sleep, because you know, you talk about being lazy, and I talk about being lazy. Boy, there's nothing sweeter there are a lot of things sweeter, but when it's occurring, there's nothing sweeter than that waking up in the morning and just kind of laying there and going back to sleep and dozing and stuff like that. But, my God, the world is so alive and so interesting that I leap out of bed, so to speak, in a manner of speaking. Okay?
Okay, John, thanks a lot, and it took a lot of the time, but I'm not speaking to you very often, so I hope this is okay.
And I think also that this conversation is useful for, this is a useful conversation to have in public anyway.
I hope so, yes.
So stay in touch with me, okay? And go to the forums. Let me know what's going on with
you. Okay, I'm going to go to the forums, definitely.
Okay.
And good luck to you and to Carla, and all the best to everybody.
You too, Adrian.
Thank
good
you.
To see you.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Okay, anybody else? Felix?
Hi, John.
Hi, Felix.
I'm enjoying how you're making it so clear that we have something in our hands now to have influence on the development of whatever happens after the first look. The only question that remains for me is the only practical question I can think of is the actual moments and situations where I appear to be able to do something, to notice consciously, oh, I'm resting on something terrible here and I can move my attention away from it to something neutral, is pretty small. So it's infinitesimally small compared to the moments where I'm just unconscious and just going with the train of thought, you see. And
I wonder if those small
moments are really enough to actually make a difference to what
you
just
say,
doing
you
nothing.
See, let me interrupt you, Felix, because I think I understand what you're asking. And you see, the thing is that what's actually occurring is that every time you do it, you get better at it. And every time you see that you're attending to that, every time you notice that, oh, yes, I am attending to that, and in the beginning there will be extremely fleeting and not very often. But every time you notice that and actually act on it, you increase your ability to notice it the next time and act on it again. You see, this is not metaphysical stuff here. This is not magic. This is fundamentally different from lifting weights to strengthen your arm. When you first start lifting weights, if you haven't had much strength training at all, you find that you really can do very, very little and not for a very long time. But as your strength increases as a result of the exercise, of course, you can do the same thing much more quickly and for a much longer period of time. What you're doing is you're strengthening your ability to have some control over your attention. And that begins with noticing that attention is resting on something. And as you say, in the beginning, those noticing moments will be few and far between and very fleeting. But every time you see that happening and move your attention away from it deliberately, you will be incrementally more capable of noticing it the next time and incrementally more skillful at being able to move it to your breath. Do you follow me?
I think I'm following you very closely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
sounds
that's
like a geometric increase in ability.
Yeah. And that's the frame that's most effective in seeing what's actually taking place here and what can be done about it. Not the frame of, I need to find something that'll solve my inability to do this, or I can't do it because I've never been able to do it. That's one frame. Another frame is, I am really not very good at this right now, but if I keep trying and I keep exercising this power I have to determine where I put my attention sometimes, that's going to happen more often, and I'm going to become much more skillful at doing it, and so forth.
Okay.
Does that answer anything for you?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Thank you, Sean.
It's just the whole, you know, once we begin to see what actually is the case, a whole different frame for understanding what's happening appears to us. And it's a frame that is self-reliant and gives us the point of view that allows us to become more effective and more effective in navigating our own lives. Okay?
Okay. So this sounds like a workable plan here.
Okay. Good. Let me know how you do, okay?
Okay.
And check out the forums if you haven't been there.
Yeah, it could be a good time to go back there again.
Okay. Good to talk to you, my friend. Stay in touch.
Good to talk to you.
Okay. Anybody else? Got a couple minutes left. Patty?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been to one of your seminars because I, too, have been getting a little discouraged. So this is just a perfect conversation for me to be hearing. And I really like your suggestions, and I will do those. But I have a question about, you know, as you say, to move our attention from whatever upset that we're caught up in and move it to our breath. And, you know, you said it's not denial, and I have my own thoughts about why that's true, but I'd really like to hear from you why that's different. I think there's kind of a fine line because in some ways it almost seems like that could be us, again, just kind of holding life at arm's length and choosing to just kind of turn away and just another technique to try to, you know, avoid it.
The difference, Patty, is that here what's happening is deliberate and intentional. The way denial works is not a deliberate and intentional movement of attention away from things. It is just a kind of an automatic refusal to attend to things whatsoever, attend to the problematic things whatsoever. It's not something that is the product of intentionality. It's just the most effective, really is the most effective and most widespread point of view that arises from the context that holds that life is not to be trusted. But it's not intentional. It's not like usually it's the opposite when we are aware of sticky and unpleasant experiences. When we're actually aware of them and we actually evoke any intentionality about them, it is in relation to them, our intention usually seems to be to sink deeper into them and kind of wallow in them. The denial happens below the psychological phenomenon of denial happens mostly below the level of conscious awareness. It's just a preferred relationship to arising phenomena. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Thanks. Yeah. So the denial is an unconscious process.
Right.
And
it's
what
unintentional.
We're doing here is much more conscious.
Right.
I think what I'm understanding. Okay, right. And then I think what I'm understanding you to say is that eventually these feelings that we now experience as upset will, once this context changes, will become simply interesting, right?
Basically, yes. Yes, they may be unpleasant and interesting, but they won't be sticky and wanting and needing to be escaped from or wallowed in. You follow that?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
You know, unpleasantness can be interesting.
I do.
And when
you're
not at stake in it, right?
Right. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
And thanks to both of you, and thanks so much for doing this.
So glad to see you here, Patty. Stay in touch. Go to the forums.
Yeah, it's actually nice to be back.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, we're gonna wrap it up now. I was going to say this anyway, and the conversation with Patty makes it particularly pertinent. something that is very, very, it's useful. You know, it's not like nothing is required. Everything will turn out just fine as it is, although it may be a very rocky road. But it's very, very useful to abandon when you are thinking about or relating to or being involved with our work here. It will be very useful for you to understand that this is not finished. That just like life, human life, is not finished. There is no point in our experience of life when we say, oh, okay, that's it. Everything is cool. Everything is just exactly as it ought to be, and I'm finished here. And our understanding of what we have discovered here, I can't find a word to express how startlingly important what we have discovered here is. But in part of what makes it what it is the fact that our understanding of what we're doing itself will never be finished. We learn as a result of the experience, our own experience, the experience of the people we work with in this thing that we're trying to do, and the experience of hearing what people have to say and what people report and what complaints are and what problems arise and so forth and so on. Our understanding of our work is always, it's a moving target. It's not something like something that is the kind of things that we are accustomed to, where we get some, finally arrive at something where, oh, everything is clear. This is life as a human being. And this work is the engagement with life as a human being. And it is like last year, at the end of the retreat last year in 2011, it seemed like we had come to the kind of complete satisfaction of what we were trying to do with the discovery, the clear discovery of the fear of life as the cause of the suffering and the looking as the cure for the suffering. Well, it turns out that although that is true enough, the actual understanding about how all this plays out and how all this occurs within the actual experience of human beings, the actual understanding of that will never be done. The actual understanding of of how to go forward and how to move forward to trying to bring this to the rest of us, the understanding of that will never be done either. So that if you come here now and you hear what I have to say now and think that that's, and probably that's enough. I mean, really, if you look at yourself, it's going to be enough. It might be a rough road for you, but it's going to be enough. But if you come and listen to me to what I say now and think that that's the clearest and most conclusive and inclusive understanding of what needs to be done that can possibly happen, you're going to be cheating yourself out of this wild ride that we're on, this adventure of discovery and exploration and conversation within the community about the wonder of being human and the fantastic nature of human life and the deep satisfaction that comes from the growing capacity to be able to be actually useful in how my life unfolds, to be actually useful in understanding how to navigate and understanding what I can do and what I cannot do to have an effect on the unfolding of my life. And in that, overall, the sheer magnificence of human existence. you know, really, this isn't great, and they've said this for a long time, and it never made any sense to me. This is a huge and great gift that comes with the arrival of me as a human being, of you as a human being. This is a great gift. This is the direction of the whole evolution of the cosmos is always in the direction of greater and more conscious and more effective experience of the wonder of existence itself. And we're here in this, at least in this little corner of the vast universe of experience and so forth, we pretty much are the top of the food chain. And it is a great tragedy that being the case, that we have been through no fault of our own, through no fault of anybody's, that we have been infected with this disease that causes our entire apparatus of relationship with life to be spoiled and poisoned by an unexamined and ever-present assumption that life is not to be trusted, that life is a problem that has to be escaped from or conquered. And now we know why, and now we know what to do. So thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to me. Thank you for trying and looking. Thank you for reporting back on your experiences. Thank you for helping us in whatever way you can possibly help us to bring this really simple thing to the world of humanity. Thank you. Thank you. I love you all. Carla has some things that are important to say. I will see you next year, I guess, unless I see you this coming Wednesday. Be well. Here's Carla.
As we approach the end of the year, please consider making a donation to support our online meetings, our meetings in person, our forums, our podcasts, our blogs, our newsletters, which are just a few of the services that we offer, always completely free of charge. The only source of funds we have to rely on to support all of this are donations from you and others like you who see the value of this work and don't want to see it disappear for lack of money. Please go to justoneloop.org and find out how you can make a monthly pledge or send a one-time donation. If you need help with that or you have any questions about donating to our organization, call me at 805-649-1600 or email me at info@justoneloop.org. We look forward to being with you in 2013, and we wish you happy holidays and a really wonderful new year. You just listened to a worldwide online meeting with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California, on December 9th, 2012. For more live recordings, visit our podcast at www.justoneloop.org.